Welcome to episode 155 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and returning to the podcast to talk about The Red Ribbon, his second installment of his series about Wiggins, Sherlock Holmes' Irregular-in-Chief, is H.B. Lyle. Once again, Ben Lyle weaves the fictional Wiggins into the extremely non-fictional world of London one decade into the 20th century. In addition to Vernon Kell, the very real founder of MI5, Winston Churchill, who at the time was Home Secretary, is also in the story. Much is afoot in London, and there's a lot for Wiggins to do, including protecting the numerous heads of state, many of them children and grandchildren of Queen Victoria, including the German Kaiser and Russian Tsar, who will be attending the funeral of their cousin, King Edward. Here's H.B. Lyle to talk about The Red Ribbon. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. We're delighted to be talking to H.B. Lyle about his new book, The Red Ribbon, which is the second in his series about Wiggins, Sherlock Holmes' one-time Irregular-in-Chief. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
I said it in the intro, Wiggins is back. He's also working again with the real-life creator of MI5, Vernon Kell, on a pair of cases, or actually it turns out I went through and there's really about four cases he's working on at one time.
And sort of official and unofficial.
Exactly. And, you know, what I liked about it was the characters from The Irregular are back. And one storyline in particular, one of his unofficial pursuits is Wiggins is still after Peter the Painter, the Russian revolutionary who caused the death of his friend. But the, you know, Vernon tries to keep him on track and investigating what the Germans in England are up to. And that includes security for the funeral of King Edward, where we should talk about that, and maybe as a separate question. But tell me about The Red Ribbon and about that particular case of the brothel.
Oh, well, that's all invented. So unlike a lot of the story, your listeners who've read The Irregular will know that there's a sort of mixture of fact and fiction in the books, and that's very much the case here as well. There's lots of factual content. So the Peter the Painter thing, the King's funeral, the sort of episode in Germany has its basis in fact, amazingly. But the brothel is my invention.
But it is a wonderful vehicle to get into the story and to get into especially the examination of class, which I think is just runs through both The Irregular and The Red Ribbon, and the plight of women, which we'll get into a little bit more deeply in a second. But that's what I liked about the brothel. This was a place where the high and the low sort of met.
Interestingly, when I had the idea to set it in a high-class brothel called the Embassy, I can't really remember the genesis of that idea, but certainly it chimes a lot with book one in the sense that book one and then the screenplay of book one that I've been working on for television is very much all about the high and the low. You know, the drawing rooms of Belgravia and the gutters of the East End, as embodied in the character of Wiggins and his boss, Kell, you know, different worlds. And so a brothel is a high-class brothel, such as the embassy, is exactly the kind of place where that mixing of the high and low happens.
And it also it gives Wiggins an opportunity to do his best to do his job. And his job, one of his jobs, is to continue to look into what Germans in England, specifically in London,
are up to. You know, what are they doing? And of course, Germans are among the people who frequent this brothel.
Well, yes, I mean, we don't want to give too much of the plot away, but of course, that German hunting thing is what MI5 was set up to do. So that was their only job, effectively, at least until the First World War. So I sort of felt like I had to keep that ticking over. You know, it would get too far from the truth if the Secret Service weren't doing that job.
And, of course, the funeral of King Edward is the perfect kind of backdrop. And, yes, it did happen. He did die then. And all of his relatives, many of whom were the heads of state of Germany, Russia, and other countries.
Well, they're all related.
And they're all related. They're all cousins. And it's kind of a great little pressure cooker of different plot lines, and I enjoyed that. You know, although it did remain safe, it was an interesting backdrop to this story.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it is a famous funeral in that sense. As I say, there were 9 crowned heads. You know, 7 of which is Queen Victoria with their grandmother. They're all interbred and sort of, which, you know, the Kaiser and the King, the Kaiser and the Tsar were all first cousins.
There was something in the book that you wrote in the book, and this doesn't spoil anything. It's actually towards the end of the book, and it's something that Vernon Kell says to Wiggins that I think gets to the core of the differences in the motivations and the work that they do and why they do it. Kell sort of triumphantly says, that's our job, to protect what we have, to conserve, to secure. That's what security means. And I thought, that's exactly right. That's exactly what Vernon Kell and the government wants, but not exactly Wiggins.
Yeah, so I'm glad you picked up on that, because I worked on that, because it is, it's sort of, that's why in this country anyway, the sort of right-wing party, as it were, is called the Conservatives. You know, that's what they want. They want to conserve what they have, and that's what conservatism is. And, of course, putting in that, and that is undoubtedly what Kell would have thought of his job for any Secret Service, is to conserve the status quo, almost, the balance of. But for someone like Wiggins, of course, that is conserving an imbalance of power. You know, it's of course the powerful want to conserve their power,
and they don't want to let anyone else participate. I think that's the secret sauce of this sort of conservatism, is that only a certain type of people in this world.
Absolutely, because letting more people in threatens that. It threatens your power. You know, I mean, the one of the many the sort of buzzwords banging around now is the sort of pathetic wailing of white middle class men when at the very scent of some kind of quota, you know, in any walk of life. So, shouldn't it be done on merit alone? It's like, it hasn't been done on merit alone for the last 500 years, so you're proposing it should be now, you know? And it's not, it is just letting, because a lot of these people that complain about letting other people in, they're not stupid. Of course, it'll be harder for them the more people you let in, but that doesn't mean it's not right, you know?
It's also how things move forward. I mean, you know, you can't just keep. I liken it to reinventing the wheel over and over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. You're totally stuck. But most importantly, it's just not fair. You know, and it's like and also it's disguised. It's disguised by sort of notions of objectivity and rationality and all that. And obviously, I'm, you know, personally a rationalist and a big supporter of reason and evidence and everything. those kind of words can be used, objectivity, to disguise, of course, massive subjectivity, because the place of objectivity traditionally has been white, middle class, and rich men. So it's their viewpoint that is seen as the correct one, and everything else is minority or, you know, different. And theirs, and I include myself in that, ours is seen as the norm, and everyone else is seen as sort of different and challenging that. And it's like, well, you know, that's not right. I think to bring it back to the book, again, these are the kind of things you work out once you've sort of written the book, or certainly the first one, that yes, it's, the underlying thing is about class, and then you look at that in different ways, and that's not just rich and poor, that's men and women. There's not so much race in this book, but that would be an issue, and et cetera, et cetera. And one of the reasons I love the height of empire, the height of the British Empire, is that you can play all those things out. Because it's a massive empire encompassing fourth of the globe, but yet it is built on progress and technological advancement and democracy and stuff like that. So it has all these, and the healthcare is getting better and all this kind of stuff. So it has all these paradoxes, but at the heart, it's still deeply unfair.
Well, I thought it was brilliant that you open up the book with Wiggins is following a pair of would-be spies, and the spies are told that they're going to be followed. They're in training to be sent to Germany to reconnoiter the German Navy. They're going to go to Bremen and look at the boats. That's how I thought of it. And the pair are a disaster. And as you said, as you said in the notes in your book, this is based on a real case. But when Wiggins points this out from behind a screen at a pub, they're just outraged that they're being spoken to in such a way. And spies, according to Cumming, Kell's counterpart in what would become MI6, believes that agents should only come from the best men, meaning, of course, the upper classes.
Absolutely, public school, etc. So that's kind of still the case, and certainly would have been the case when it was set up. You would have, it's the old gentleman, you know, gentlemen and amateurs and professionals, etc. So that, I don't think those views are particularly, I haven't particularly invented them for those characters, I don't think.
Oh, no, not at all. I just thought the way this pair, their outrage, as you describe it in the story, is it would be funnier if the consequences weren't so tragic, I think.
But that's all true.
I know, and it's...
Well, a lot of it's true. Obviously, Wiggins and Kell and Cummings' involvement is perhaps invented, but what happened to those two guys? I couldn't have invented that because my editor would have said that's a bit, you know, far-fetched or outrageous. This wouldn't really happen. But of course, it did really happen, and so in the way I described, so it's like it's a gift in that way. If any of your listeners end up buying the book and thinking this is ridiculous, then I would just send them to a couple of history books and to see it actually did happen.
No, I agree. Truth is stranger than fiction. I was at an event, and a writer, Lee Goldberg, was speaking, and he said, "Look, you know, we live in a country, in the United States, where a former reality show host is now president, and he's had an affair with a porn star, and, you know, what is there left? There's nothing left that we can write about that's outrageous. There's, you know, it's all out there now."
Well, it's awful. It's like some terrible second-rate YA dystopian novel. You know, it's like some kind of horrible movie, like The Hunger Games or something. Or the posh version, it's like, it's much worse than The Plot Against America, you know, the Philip Roth.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, God, I only read that 15 years ago and it seemed like, oh, well, you know. And then now it's much worse than that already.
But I'm just, you know, just as you said, it's editors have to, maybe now we're turning to fiction to get a view of a story. It might not be true because it's fiction, but it's true because it's giving us the story that explains what's going on. And maybe that's why fiction is, to me, more important now than ever.
I always think that anyway. I think you can be. I actually prefer reading fiction to nonfiction. I read it to research and stuff like that. But to me, there's more profound truth in fiction because if the writer is good and they happens upon something, you can fully articulate it rather than getting bogged down by the facts and the facts obscuring the emotional truth of something. They can get in the way, you know. I think if you're not, unless you're a really superb writer, I think fiction is often a place where you can find more revealing emotional truth than nonfiction.
So, but back to The Red Ribbon.
Sure.
You've got, because we could wander off on this topic for hours. Vernon's wife, Constance, was in the first book, and we got to know her. She was a suffragist who, you know, earnestly wrote letters to the members of Parliament and did her best to show that she was, how women deserved the vote, because, of course, this was a time before women could vote. And she's a suffragist, though, and through meeting a group of women, becomes attracted to the suffragette movement. So I wanted you to talk about the difference between the two terms at the time, because now they're interchangeable, and they shouldn't be.
Yes, well, it sounds as if you probably know more about that than I do, but initially the suffragette was a coinage from the Daily Mail, which is a rather sort of right-wing and rabid newspaper in this country, and was back then as well, 100 and so years ago. And they coined it as a term of semi-abuse to, you know, like usherette or something, the suffragettes. But then it was kind of reclaimed as a word for... Now, I've forgotten the name. There's two major organisations for women's suffrage. And I've forgotten there's like an acronyms of like five letters, NSWPP, etc. But the easiest way to think about them is that the suffragettes in effect were more militant. So the suffragists they were asking for the same thing, but the suffragettes were much more prepared to. They were interested in direct action. So the images now we see of the women's suffrage movement, of the hunger strikers, the terrorism, Emily Davison jumping in front of the King's horse at the Derby. They would have been. It was like the sort of militant half of the movement, as it were.
Well, I read one place as I was researching the questions for our talk that the suffragists were asking for the right to vote and the suffragettes were demanding it and willing to go to extremes to get the vote. So
absolutely. That's a good way of putting it. It's like asking and demanding, you know. And one set of people were... It's the difference between evolution and revolution.
Exactly.
You know, one said we're going gradually through using Parliament and writing the letters, etc., and the suffragettes were demanding it and acting and, you know, bombing the house of the Chancellor of the Exchequer and ministers, and there was assassination plots, etc., etc. So, you know, they could easily have been called and often were called terrorists.
And of course, now that Constance, Vernon Kell's wife, and of course he's the head of MI5, and you know there's and it's a new government organization, and there are always rivals, and his wife Constance puts herself and by extension Vernon in the sights of surveillance by Scotland Yard's special branch, which is, you know, the closest thing I think the UK likes to say has to a secret police. So Constance becomes leverage for Sir Patrick Quinn, who's head of the special branch, and Kell knows this because he's seen a surveillance photo of his wife in Sir Patrick's office. So this is, you know, this is serious stuff. I mean, both fictionally and, you know, you could see how this could be leveraged, how Sir Patrick could leverage this.
Yes, I quite like the idea of, because you read the accounts of these things like the Secret Service, MI5, MI6 being set up, etc., etc., and the official histories, they're so full of, to be honest, boring admin, because all these things are administrations, really, you know, and there's a bit of action here and there. But it's all about their budgets and competing with rival departments and stuff. So I like the idea of the competing, but obviously you want to dramatize that.
No, absolutely,
you
know, yes.
Make it more vital and more close to home. And it wasn't my initial plan, but then I wrote the scene there when Kell goes to see the head of special branch about something. And I wrote the scene, and then as I was writing it, I wrote that he saw his wife in a photo on the wall with a question mark by her. And so it was almost like that scene started off significant parts of that storyline, because I just thought, wow, that would be a great scene. You could imagine it in a film as well.
Well, then also it frightens Kell, and you know back to the point of the competing agencies. You've got another real life character, Winston Churchill, and you know most people who are aware of Winston Churchill, especially in the United States, know him through World War II. But he had been a very active and manipulative and Machiavellian politician since the Boer Wars of the late 19th century. And I thought the way you had him instrumental in the competition among and between the agencies was really good. It was I don't know if he really did it or if it was a way for you to set it up, but it really was brilliant and brought out some of his less savory characteristics.
Oh, yeah, he's not a particularly savory character. He was involved in top flight politics for 35 years before he became prime minister at the war, and he was in all the sort of, he had most of the top jobs in politics in Britain. For the other side as well, so your listeners, he was the equivalent of Republican, then Democrat, and then Republican again. Conservative, then Liberal, then Conservative again. He was very interested in power. And I haven't manipulated that much. Obviously, I've invented conversations there, but he was at the siege of Sydney Street, for example. He does turn up. He's the Home Secretary. And he did order the cavalry in, the army, to at industrial disturbances in Tunnypandy in Wales that are referenced in the book, but you don't go there. So he is the Home Secretary, and obviously at that time the Home Secretary didn't have control of MI5, which he does now, which they do now. He didn't then. He had control of the police. So it's not that much of a stretch of the imagination for me to think that he would be interested, because he was the Home Secretary in this country, is in charge of all the police. At that stage, the MI5 was under the auspices of the War Office, the Department of Defence, as it would be called. And so it's perfectly reasonable for me to think that he would be interested in what they were doing, as well as, you know. and potentially use them. Obviously, the invention is this super working class agent Wiggins has got special access. But I'm sure had he existed, Churchill would have been the kind of person to use him. Yes, he would have been practical. So in the Second World War, so I've just got my point. In the Second World War, for example, one of his favourite departments was the saboteur department of the MI6. It's called the Special Operations Executive, it would be called. Which is the people sent in to occupied Europe to create mayhem and invent gadgets that just blow up and all that kind of stuff. He loved them. You know, he'd give them all sorts of money and stuff to devise some new stranger bomb or, you know, all this kind of stuff. So, yes, absolutely non-conventional.
By the end of the Red Ribbon, Wiggins has had it. He's, it's just like the London is grinding him down, working for Cal is working him down. He does like Constance. They have a friendship. It's not at all romantic. By the end, he's just tired of the class and the clashes between the upper classes and how he and his friends are exploited. And so he's off. He's out of there. And I don't want to spoil the end of the book, but this is a roundabout way of asking if there are going to be more stories about Wiggins, which is, does he arrive at his destination when he decides to leave London?
That's the plan. There's another one in a roundabout way. I haven't written the book yet, but it should be out. If it's not out next year, I'll finish it next year, and it'll be out the year after. It'll be out in the spring of 2020. So I don't think it'll be out 2019, 2020. But yes. I haven't decided how much time he's going to spend at that destination, because it's more about another country. It's more about Ireland, it's about three countries. But yes, he will go to that destination because that is a place that I love. He won't go on that specific piece of transport, though.
Okay, so that's one of the questions. You know, it's a really interesting time. I could see why, as you're getting into the middle of the following decade, things are very interesting in Ireland. The revolution is brewing. I think the things that happened at the beginning of the 20th century are just completely... they laid the groundwork for so much of what's going on now.
I mean, absolutely. So one of the reasons I'm interested in that he'll go to Ireland is about gun running, and that still connects with because both the north and south of Ireland ended up building up their guns before the First World War, encouraged by Germany, was selling them guns. But at the moment in this country, they're still trying to deal with the madness that is Brexit, and the biggest single issue about Brexit is what you do about Ireland. That's the unsolved issue. Other than the fact that it's total madness, and that is the biggest single issue. And we can trace that back 100 years, and that was still one of the biggest single issues.
You can trace it back 1,000 years to King John.
Well, yeah, with that one. But one of the issues of the third book, I think, will also be guns, which I think is a modern-day issue as well. Certainly from where you're from, the world is still dealing with, or certainly America is still dealing with, or not dealing with, as the case may be. So the early 20th century is when that those instruments of death can become so mass-produced.
And you mentioned in passing, and I really have to ask, the Irregular is becoming a live-action television thing. That's fantastic.
Well, it's in development, so we'll see. It hasn't been commissioned. It's been commissioned as a screenplay, but not as a production, because, of course, it would be very expensive and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you'll have to find, you know, $20 million under the sofa, you know, so...
and the torturous journey to production.
Yeah, exactly.
Starts.
So, well, you know about that from where you're from. So, so there's no guarantees in that sense, but hopefully.
Well, I think it would be a fantastic series because there's so much that weaves in and out of it, and my fingers are crossed.
Well, thank you. As are mine, yeah.
Ben, it's been great to talk to you again, and I'm looking forward to the third book. I know that 2020 will come around sooner than I think, but it seems like a long time away.
Well, it's a long time away for me because I've got to write the book yet. So, yeah. So that always takes longer than you think. Thank you so much for having me on. It's fantastic to be on and to talk to you again about the book. And